are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Hey, if you like the stories you hear on The Majority Report, then check out the Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust brings you 14 storytellers from across the Western U.S. who share their experiences in harvesting, protecting, and living with the four natural elements, with tales of climate change, clean energy, and everything in between. Listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories. That's beyondcoal.org/stories or on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 17th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Beth Macy, author of Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and Drug Companies That Addicted America. Also on the program today, Brett Kavanaugh's accuser goes public as his support begins to slowly crumble. Meanwhile, all the details are out. Manafort is cooperating big time. Meanwhile, Mike Bloomberg may run as a Democrat. And why this should make you happy. Also, you should know Donald Trump has your phone number and he plans to use it this week. Ted Cruz's desperate donation fail and John Roberts intervenes to allow dark money to continue to flow. The Working Families Party won't give Cuomo their ballot line in New York. And cleaning up from Hurricane Florence, 17 people dead in the Carolinas. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We're not going to totally break format today, but we're going to start our guests just a little bit later than normal, because of the news about Brett Kavanaugh. Now, on Friday, we had reported that there was a letter that was sent to Dianne Feinstein alleging something to the effect, we hadn't seen the letter at that point, that Brett Kavanaugh had, as a teenager, in some fashion, sexually assaulted a woman, or at that time, a girl. And the question at that time was, why didn't Dianne Feinstein share this information with other members of the committee? The story has evolved a little bit as to her reasoning, right? Because they clearly messed up. If someone sends a letter to the committee, and we don't know the TikTok yet, as far as I know. The letter was sent in July. We don't know how much interaction Feinstein herself or staffers had with this woman, but clearly the woman was interested in at least putting this on the record. This should have been sent to the FBI at that time, even if it was deemed to be made confidential. Nevertheless, someone leaked it last week. Ryan Grimm had the story in The Intercepted. This weekend, the accuser made herself known, anticipating that her name was going to get out anyways, I think.
Mike Cernovich had people on that.
Is that right?
Yep.
Her name is Christine Blasey Ford. She is a professor of clinical psychology in California. And the most damning thing that is going to prove the most difficult thing for Brett Kavanaugh, who, remember now, has unequivocally denied these charges. And we'll say more about the other man who was with him at that time as to his denials. But put that aside. The most damning thing for Kavanaugh in this situation, and the hardest thing I think for the Republicans to do, because you know they're going to try and discredit this woman, is that in 2012, this woman told her couple's therapist and her husband about what she perceived as an attempted rape at that time. And the therapist has the notes. So for us to believe that Christine Blasey Ford is lying is for us to believe that she planned to promulgate this lie 6 years ago in anticipation if Kavanaugh ever was appointed or nominated to the Supreme Court, right? It wasn't enough as a federal court judge. She was holding back. And then the only other thing that you could say is that she is completely remembering this, that it was different people or that it never happened or whatnot, which is also a very hard thing to argue. We're not talking about a 3-year-old here. We're talking about when she was 15 years old. And so then the question was, would she testify? Her lawyer, Deborah Katz, went on the NBC Today show this morning with this.
Total strangers. And of course, that's extremely unsettling.
Obviously, we've just heard the details of her story. She alleges a sexual assault back in high school. One of the therapist's notes from a few years ago when she recounted this states that it was an attempted rape. My question to you is, does she consider this an attempted rape?
She does. She clearly considers this an attempted rape. She believes that if it were not for the severe intoxication of Brett Kavanaugh, she would have been raped.
The other person who was in the room, a man by the name of Mark Judge, according to your client, says this didn't happen. He said it's just nuts. This didn't happen. Your response?
Well, he's also written 3 books and many, many articles and Twitter posts that have all now been completely scrubbed from the public domain, where he acknowledges that that was behavior that from his Georgetown prep school days, that they routinely engaged in tremendous drinking and really inappropriate behavior, and that the drinking was so severe that they were blacked out regularly. That's now been scrubbed.
Yeah. Ms. Katz, is your client willing to testify before the Judiciary Committee publicly and tell this story?
She is. She's willing to do whatever it takes to get her story forth, yes.
First off, it needs to be said that this woman, Christine Ford, has an incredible amount of, I mean, and to a certain extent, this is not unlike what happened with Anita Hill. Anita Hill initially had no desire to testify. She felt obligated to notify the committee of her experience of working with Clarence Thomas, and her name was leaked. And then at that point, she wanted to at least have an ability to impact what her fate was going to be. And it certainly appears that it's the same situation with Christine Ford. Once it became clear that there were reporters who were camping out on her door before she was public, she realized that she has to take control of the narrative. And the idea that she is willing to testify, it seems almost impossible for Republicans in the Senate to avoid reopening the hearings if they want this nomination to go forward. Almost impossible, only because I have some experience with the Republican Party. With that said, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, they have the ability, by telling Mitch McConnell, we are going to vote no if you have this vote in the committee on Thursday without reopening, they have the ability to dictate what happens next. No one should forget this. If you live in Maine and you live in Alaska, and even if you don't, it is definitely worthwhile to let those two senators know that you know they have the ability to stop this process dead in its tracks. They hold all the cards. And we are going to watch the right move from these are ridiculous and anonymous to, well, she's lying, to, well, he was only 17, to he was really drunk and didn't know what he was doing. That's the way this is going to progress.
They're already doing it.
Okay. And then the question is, there's plenty of times where people do things when they are 17, highly intoxicated, and they do it only once, and they regret it. And those people who are not disingenuous liars do not later deny that they did it. They do not then say, she is a liar, and she is trying to derail my nomination to the Supreme Court. What they do is they step forward and they accept responsibility for what they did. And they talk about how they realized it was a mistake and they lived with that for many years and it impacted their behavior and it changed them. And they understand that this can happen and that it's wrong. And then, you know, like a person like that, there's something to be said judging their credibility of and their lives up to that point, that maybe that person is suited to sit on the Supreme Court or to any court for that matter, to be in a position to adjudicate behavior. Now, I also don't think you could take this incident and Brett Kavanaugh's complete unequivocal denial. And remember, it's not just him coming out and saying, I don't know about this. It is, let's get a letter with 63 women that I supposedly knew in high school at the all boys school I went to, and get them to support me. Let's get the let's do what every other Supreme Court judge is and bring out every female basketball team I coached. Let's have every woman I know. Like, this denial is not just when he said this, when it came out. This denial has been in the works for weeks.
Carpool Dad.
For weeks. This is not a denial, it's a campaign of denial. Now, maybe they did it just for this one incident. Maybe there's other incidents, but if it's just this one incident, this guy is so far away from accepting responsibility that it's impossible for us to believe that it was a meaningless event, right? Because even if it was not a meaningless event, even if it was the worst thing that he did as a 17-year-old, but it shouldn't count against him today as a Supreme Court nominee, then he should have had the ability to say, I disavow that. I learned from that. I don't do that. And yet, instead, what we get is a campaign of denial. So there's no excuse for this guy. That time has passed. And now it's up to Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, because we now know that every Democrat is going to vote against this guy if it's brought up to a vote. And we see nothing else. There's no reason that this has to go forward without a hearing here. Now, I don't know if there's any ability to get to the bottom of this. And I certainly wouldn't vote for this guy, but I wouldn't have voted for this guy before. But the idea of having some measure of not necessarily a contemporaneous record, but one that predates this, his nomination by 6 years. I mean, I'd like to hear the explanation as to what was in her mind when she told her couples therapist this 6 years ago, if it wasn't true.
Yeah, one thing that jumps out at me about this whole thing is that it's often used against rape victims, the fact that they were drinking, you know, like, oh, if you were drinking, how can you possibly remember this properly? You know, you're an unreliable witness to your own rape. And if that is the case, I don't see why this doesn't also apply to the accused, right? Because this guy, at least his friend, has a documented history of being blackout drunk at that point in his life. So maybe they should say, you know, if you were drinking, how can you be sure you didn't rape somebody?
Right. Well, the point is, you don't even have to get that far. The point is, like, if there's someone can take some measure of responsibility for their actions because they're drinking too much, it cuts both ways. But the really damning thing about her story is this is not a, well, maybe someone misinterpreted the signs or this and that. I mean, if her story is true, this is a guy who knew that there was no consent. That's why they raised the stereo, the sound of the stereo, so that people wouldn't hear her saying no. Well, that they, he put her hand, his hand over her mouth. I mean, this isn't one of those, like, people were drinking, nobody could tell what was going on. I mean, this is clearly, so there's no, this is a, I would like to see Brett Kavanaugh explain this. Explain, like, why he thinks this woman told her therapist about it 6 years ago.
And why, if you were making up a story, you would have the corroborating witness in the room be one of his friends?
Right, exactly. Like, why would you have a friend in there?
Yeah.
Right, just, if you're making this up, like, that's a really, really
risky,
strategy.
Not to mention, if you were going to make up a story, wouldn't you make it even worse?
Indeed.
Like, this is very specific.
No, I mean, I think it is going to be impossible for Murkowski and Collins to ignore this. And that's what they would have to do to move forward. We will talk more about Mark Judge later and in more of this, because this is obviously a big deal. And look, well, there's a lot more to this. There's every reason to believe that the Republicans are going to, if Kavanaugh's nomination goes down, they're going to nominate someone from a ideological standpoint just as bad. And they could push this through the lame duck, but we shall see. Folks, summer's still around with us a little bit. People are feeling the heat. Or, in Michael's case, after a long night out, could use a little extra hydration. For when your family wants a healthy, clean ingredient alternative to sugary sports drinks, thankfully, Liquid IV prevents dehydration, especially while spending more time outside at the beach, hiking, having fun. Liquid IV is not your average electrolyte drink mix. It has non-GMO, clean ingredients, healthy alternative to traditional sport drinks, and can provide the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. It even contains 5 essential vitamins, including more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. They even have convenient TSA-friendly powder packets that help prevent jet lag and altitude sickness for all your summer travels. I have used this multiple occasions after having a slightly too much to drink the night before. I have a good friend. She tends to get a little bit dehydrated. Not necessarily a sports drinker, and got high marks from there. But I'm just saying, what?
You're very excited. Your new lifestyle is adorable.
Okay. Meanwhile, Liquid IV, we can barely keep them in the office. In fact, I think there's only one packet left. Brendan was like, I thought last time during the ad you said they were yours, and so I haven't asked you for it. I was like, dude, you can have one.
Oh, yeah. Like, don't nervous. Touch the liquid.
Wait, but don't touch that flavor.
It's mine.
Right now, my listeners get 20% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Go to liquid-iv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquid-iv.com. Promo code MAJORITY. We put that in the liner notes of the podcast. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. And then, at the end of your day, folks, oh, this is also, this is a bit of a coincidence, but guess who had a quip? The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. Right. Not for light, just that's right. Not for
I'm
long.
Walking
not,
on okay. sunshine.
And forget to change our brush see? On. Okay. Most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. They are set up, like I've said this a million times before, you can have an electric toothbrush. If you don't use it and you don't use it properly and you don't switch out the brush head, it's useless. Quip is an electric toothbrush that costs a fraction of the bulkier brushes, packs the right amount of vibrations to clean your teeth. The built-in timer and guiding pulses help you clean for the full dentist recommended 2 minutes. That means no more singing your ABCs twice, like I got to do with my kids. Quip subscription is built for your health. It delivers a new brush head every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a suction mount that unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel. The travel part, in my estimation, is one of the best things about Quip. Because you continue the habit, even when you're traveling, you never have an excuse to get out of the habit of brushing your teeth well. Everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List. They were named one of Time's best innovations. And it's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the ADA. That's the American Dental Association. They're even backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers. I am one. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. That's getquip.com/majority. Check it out. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to Beth Macy about Dope Sick, the opioid epidemic that continues to this day in this country.
No.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Beth Macy. She is a journalist and author of multiple books. Her latest book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, is out now. It chronicles the more than now 20-year history of the opioid epidemic. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, let's start just, I mean, you know, and I think this audience is fairly familiar with different aspects of this because we have spoken not just to journalists but to lawyers who are working on various cases going after this. But give us a sense of what are the numbers that we're talking about? Like when we talk about the this as an epidemic, how many people, but for the development of, and I, you know, I guess it's sort of hard to know this, but for the development and the prescription of them getting OxyContin, let's say, or, you know, any of the sort of like the other opioids that have been, that have followed in its wake, what are the numbers of people who have become addicted?
Yeah, so this is the number that really kind of made the hair stand up on the back of my neck and also made me realize how fast overdose deaths are increasing. In the last 15 years, we've lost 300,000 people to drug overdose deaths, and we're going to lose that many more in just the next five.
Wow.
And so I tell the story through the ground level, but if you go back to these distressed rural areas where people were being prescribed immediate release painkillers for workplace injuries, et cetera, especially in central Appalachia, you talk to doctors there, they have one, two, maybe three people that they were treating in the course of a year for drug dependence. And as soon as that drug came on the market, their practices just became overwhelmed with people, as did the jails, as did, you know, being called out in the middle of the night to a drug overdose death for a child you had immunized as a baby, you know. And so it really happened very quickly. What the book points out is that it took our nation so long to get a handle on it because it began in these politically unimportant places. And then when it moved to the cities and suburbs with, you know, I feature this upper middle class suburb near where I live in Roanoke, Virginia. People were just so ashamed and there was such a big stigma that they hid it from their neighbors that this was happening in their households.
All right. So I want to get to that question of places and that evolution. But so just to be clear, and I think people need to understand this, there have been changes in the way these drugs are prescribed. There is a greater awareness among doctors about the implications of them. But the addiction epidemic is still growing, right? Like this isn't abating. It's growing, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Like I said, if you look at that number, it's just going with no sign of plateauing until, quote, sometime after 2020. And the thing is, even though doctors are now prescribing fewer opioids, and certainly I hope no longer prescribing for moderate pain, which was the big change that happened in the mid to late 90s when Purdue and other pharmaceutical companies were pushing this idea that was pain. Pain was being undertreated, and now it was, even though centuries of history indicated that morphine is always addictive, morphine-based products. You know, now we're prescribing less, but we still have 2.6 million people with opioid use disorder. And we know because we've studied what happens in these communities that it's not a quick fix. John Kelly at Harvard says it takes the typical person who's addicted to opioids 8 years and 5 to 6 treatment attempts just to get 1 year of sobriety.
Wow. And, you know, because I asked that question, I had occasion to talk to an attorney who was doing litigation against the McKessons, like the distributors. And he described it as it's like a snake eating a rat. Like this mass of people is going to go through the system. And we haven't even seen it crest yet.
We haven't. And if you look at all these children that are now being raised by grandparents and foster care, I mean, that's one of the things I'm learning is I went out and I did all this reporting for 2.5 years on this book. And now people are coming to my events and they're sharing other stories. And, you know, I got a letter from somebody the week the book came out, she had been to my talk, my kind of book launch talk, and she runs a foster care nonprofit in the region. And she said, last month we had 100 requests for foster care placement, largely due to opioid people who've been orphaned by the opioid epidemic. She said, we found homes for 7 of them. So what happens to the other 93? And what happens to these kids later in life? I mean, it's really a national disgrace, in my opinion.
Well, all right, let's talk about these places, because I think I remember a statistic on the number of children in foster care in Roanoke, and it was extraordinarily high.
Yeah, and not even as bad as it is in these rural distressed communities. I mean, in Appalachia, it's as high as 50%.
Wow. All right, well, let's start. I mean, it may not seem obvious, and you've touched on it just briefly, but about those initial hotspots, what were the hotspots? Like, if we were to track and watch it on sort of like an animated graph, and we would watch these places, tell us what we would see first and why, and then how it migrated.
Yeah. So you would first see it becoming a real problem with jails filling up and overdoses happening in these areas where factories were closing, where coal mines were shutting down, in places like Machias, Maine, where there was lots of logging and fishermen, places where there were lots of workplace injuries, so where people were already being prescribed immediate-release opioids before OxyContin came out. And the thing Purdue Pharma did with OxyContin is they hired an army of reps, and they bought this data that showed them which doctors and which towns were prescribing the most immediate-release opioids. So they knew who the competitors were and exactly who to target. So let's say you're Dr. Smith and you're practicing in Machias, Maine, and you have a lot of loggers who have been there or fishermen who've had workplace incidents. You're going to get a call now from a Purdue rep, and this is mid to late 90s, who's preaching this notion that pain is being largely undertreated. And because we have this brand new time-release mechanism that allows OxyContin, a drug stronger than any that had prior been on the market, to allegedly bleed out over 12 hours, it's much safer. And the FDA allowed them to say the new time release mechanism made it, it is believed to reduce the abuse for dependence and overdose. And so it was supposed to be safer. Addiction was, quote, exquisitely rare or less rare and only happened in less than 1% of cases. So this was a narrative being pushed in doctors' offices all across the country. Purdue hired 5,000 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists to become paid speakers. And they really did a full-on assault. But it starts out in these distressed areas because that's where there were legitimate workplace injuries. But if you look at the families that I profile in those areas, those folks have always been able to take, say, 2 weeks of Vicodin or Percocet for a simple workplace injury and then largely be finished with it at the end of the course. The difference was, as a police officer put it to me, OxyContin turned a lot of people into non-functioning people because it was so strong. And a lot of people immediately figured out an end run around the 12-hour mechanism.
And so it was, I mean, it was both were a problem, right? Like that it was stronger than, it would zonk you out more than you anticipated. And
right,
which
sets you up for addiction.
Right, okay.
Better. Mm-hmm. And then they realized it because the jobs were going away. It was something, it was its own resource to be plundered. They could doctor shop, say you had lost your job in a textile plant. You could go to your doctor and say, you know, my back's really giving me trouble. And because of this new narrative being pushed by Purdue and other opioid makers, the pain was undertreated and that OxyContin was safe now for moderate pain. I mean, that was the big thing.
Right.
You could go and say you had back pain, something that's hard to prove. They would write you OxyContin and then you could sell it to your neighbors who were already addicted for $1 a milligram. So it became a way for people to pay their bills.
Right. And then, okay, so, and we see this in the data. We see these, towns in Appalachia or, towns in Maine that are hit, Ohio, that are hit.
Ohio.
Just devastated. And then where does it go? How does it migrate there? Is it just that The marketing campaign just expands.
Well, the marketing campaign was everywhere. I'm saying it becomes a problem earlier in these rural areas, which had never had, like, you know, people left their doors unlocked. And, you know, I remember a story early on, a guy making a night deposit for the grocery store that he managed was murdered as he was, you know, making his deposit because somebody was addicted to OxyContin and needed money to go buy more. And that fear of dope sickness was creating this crime never before seen. I mean, that people are stacked up in the jail. One man traded his family's mule for four pills. So crime at that level had never before seen. But at the same time, these reps are going everywhere in the country, right? So it's just not becoming as well known in places that aren't as distressed. So it's happening in New York. It's happening where I live in Virginia, which is not a distressed region everywhere. It just doesn't really show up as a huge problem because the crime wasn't, you know, changing the way it was in these truly distressed areas. So when it really kind of slaps people in the face where I live here in Roanoke is when a pair of local weathermen overdosed at a party, and it became local news, and everybody went, "What? Wealthy white guys?" And then, and that was 2006. In 2010, you see a bunch of kids get caught trading or using and selling, because anyone who becomes addicted, many people who become addicted also start selling it in order to fund their own habit. A couple of private school kids get ensnared in this, and not just a couple, but a couple get caught. One dies. The other is about to go to prison for his role in his classmate's death. And I do a series, I'm then a newspaper reporter in 2012, I do a series on this, and people are just like, what? Wealthy white kids are doing heroin? And of course, that was just the tip of the iceberg. The reason it was so slow becoming, you know, people becoming aware of it in the cities and suburbs were the wealthier kids had the money to hide right. their addiction. They could say their iPad was stolen and their parents would buy them a new one when really they had pawned it for drugs. And the parents who were in on the quote, dirty little secret had the money to send their kids off to rehab and they were too ashamed to tell their neighbors. So it was really this perfect storm in each location, but it just becomes, as the public becomes aware of it, the timing is different for that. And so the last locality I talk about in the book is a little idyllic farm town, which is not a distressed community in the northern Shenandoah Valley, which, you know, has a twice convicted drug dealer lands and there are already people who are addicted to pills, and he sort of brings heroin in bulk, and that town goes from having a handful of users to almost hundreds overnight. And so what I try to do in the book,
that's Ronnie Jones, right?
That's Ronnie. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I want to get into some individuals, but I'm fascinated by this because I'm also aware that the numbers of Latinos and African Americans who became addicted was lower because they didn't have access to health care. I mean, so it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting that like there is a sweet spot on some level of that pushed this this addiction epidemic, where there was enough money to have access to medical care, but not enough to really to inhibit people. Like, you know, in the wealthier areas, you're not going and pretending you have a back problem to sell to your buddies or your friends who are addicted, because mm-hmm. you have enough money to not do that. So in that instance, the sort of like not complete poverty, but significant enough, it seems like, struggle to the middle class was an accelerant, because the need for the money was there, but there was enough also to get initial access.
Right. You thought your money protected you, but in fact, it kind of did the opposite in this. There's just so many unintended consequences everywhere. But as you said, like, in terms of getting addicted to pills, people of color were sort of predicted by good old-fashioned racism, right? Doctors didn't trust them not to overuse it, or they didn't have access to go to the doctor. But now you see numbers in people of color, overdose numbers in particular because of fentanyl, especially in the urban areas, in middle class Latino and African American men, overdose deaths actually being higher because they're coming out of jail at a rate higher than white people are, because they're going to jail at a higher rate. And many who are using who were using before because they got no treatment in jail, they come out of jail and they go back to using what they were using before, only now it has fentanyl in it. And as someone said, if it's raining in the white community, it's a tsunami in the black community. Wow. So they're less likely to call 911 for police because they don't trust them. And they're less likely to have access to health care. So, of course, now there's just no demographic in America that's been untouched by this.
Let's just talk a little bit more about the marketing and the family that owned Purdue as the drivers of this. In 2000, the marketing budget was $4 billion. Is that right? I mean, I wrote that down in my notes, but I look at it, it doesn't seem correct to me.
That doesn't seem correct to me either. I think that might be a bit high. Where did you get that from?
Oh, I don't know. I thought I had taken.
Yeah, knowing the marketing budget off the top of my head, but certainly I quoted the marketing budget because I have access to it in the book, and it's correct in the book. But yeah, I mean, they spent a lot of money on marketing, and no, $4 billion would be way too much.
Really? That seems extraordinary. I think I may have just written it down wrong.
Yeah. Between 06 and 15, the whole pharmaceutical industry, opioid makers spent almost $1 billion on lobbying and political campaigns. So think about that, and think about who you're voting for and whether or not they're accepting money from these opioid makers.
There was an attempt also, I mean, I guess this was about a year or two ago, to change the guidelines for these distributors who are in between, obviously the manufacturers. The distributors have a statutory obligation to report any type of like blips. And they obviously saw different areas where, you know, there are more pills going in than people.
Out of tiny Kermit, West Virginia. Yeah. Eric Geyer at the Charleston, West Virginia paper did some great reporting on that. Kermit, West Virginia, I think it had 400 some people, and I forget how many millions of pills went there in 1 year. I mean, just ridiculous and no oversight at all.
Well, let's talk about treatment models, because there's, you know, that's the stage we're in at. Well, or actually, before we get there, tell us what's been done. So you say this is going to crest around 2020. Explain to us why.
Sometime after 2020, the latest model I looked at, sometime after 2020, it was vague.
Okay. Let's assume.
The hopeful thing, though, I was just going to say, the hopeful spot, though, is we are starting to see decreased overdoses in a few New England states. And it's exactly what you would think if you looked at the research. It's the states that are making it easier for people with opioid use disorder to get treatment, to medication-assisted treatment, methadone or buprenorphine, and are making harm reduction models more available, syringe exchange and recovery programs, using this model where if you show up as an overdose person in the ER, they will immediately get you in an MAT buprenorphine program. You're starting to see slight decreases in overdoses, and this is consistent with all the research on methadone and buprenorphine. If used correctly and in conjunction with counseling, it really is the number one way to turn back the opioid crisis. But where you live in this country says a lot about whether or not you're going to get that kind of treatment or not.
Okay, well, there's two facets, right? There is to the extent that new addicts are being created, and then there's to the extent that society is responding to this epidemic. So let's just give me a sense of where we are in terms of the creation of new addicts, because that, is that bulk of people at one point, theoretically, if we're, you know, whether it's 2022 or 2026 or whenever it is.
Yeah.
The the factors that created so many addicts have been in some way shut down? I mean, tell us that process.
Yeah. So in 2016, the CDC put out guidelines. Now, they were voluntary, but a lot of local or statewide board of medicines have put out the guidelines of their own that aren't voluntary. And so you now, I think every state but one has mandatory PMPs or prescription where the doctor has to check to make sure they're not being shopped. The customer isn't or patient isn't going to multiple doctors. And the CDC is now saying only use opioids. Go back to what we did for 100 years. Only use opioids in very severe cases of pain and at end of life and cancer pain or post-surgery. It's not safe for moderate, which we always knew it wasn't until this narrative got flipped in the mid to late 90s. So the CDC is now saying, try Tylenol and aspirin first. Don't go first to an opioid. So I think you're going to see new addicts being created at a lesser rate, which is really good. But as I said earlier, the problem is we had 2.6 million people already addicted. Some experts think that number is higher, closer to 4 million. And the horse is out of the barn. So we need to get those people treatment. And, in 100 years ago, we had a huge opioid epidemic after the Civil War because morphine was given out like candy. You know, you didn't even have to have a doctor sign off on the prescribing of it back then. And that's when heroin was developed as a cure for morphine. I get into that a bit in the book. But basically, those addicts died out. They waited for the addicts to die out. Mm. Are we going to do that with 4 million people? That's crazy. I mean, we know what the fix is for this, and it's going to cost a lot of money. Some people think it's going to cost a lot of $1 billion over the course of 10 years. And we're just seeing dribs and drabs out of Congress. It's going to take a lot more effort than what's being seen now. And a true national emergency, not a public health emergency, which we saw Trump declare.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the difference. I mean, in that, I think Zika came up at one point as an analog. But I mean, give us a sense of the cost associated with this. You know, that I mean, because this is a sort of a classic case, right? Of the profits are privatized and the enormous amounts of cost to society is socialized.
That's why you see all these lawsuits now, you know, little towns and states and Native American tribes trying to get back all the costs from foster care and law enforcement and jail and, you know, all those things. I'm hopeful that the judge in Cleveland overseeing 1,000 lawsuits is going to come out with meaningful treatment paid for by these, you know, billionaires that have, you know, gotten super wealthy selling these drugs, overselling these drugs based on, questionable claims about them. Andrew Kalodny at Brandeis says it's going to take $60 billion over the next 10 years. But, wow. You know, so far Congress has approved 4.5. And it's an increase over the year before, but very slow to trickle down. I mean, the last time I checked, only 25% of the Cures Act money had even made it down to localities. And I just think if we had national leadership, if we had state leadership and local leadership really stepping up to the plate on this, that's what it's going to take. But the public health emergency that Trump declared, you know, authorized no new funds, no new authorities. So it's a national disgrace.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about the various people that you spoke to. Were you able, obviously you spoke to sort of almost everyone you could imagine in the context who was touched by this in some fashion. And ones that I think your average person wouldn't really realize, but where did you get the sense that there was the most remorse? Like what players in this, this mix had remorse for their role in this, or were there any?
Wow, that's such a great question. No one has asked me that in all the scores of interviews I've given, I saw no remorse coming from any pharmaceutical executive. I saw just denial in every quarters. But, you know, doctors will say, well, we were lied to by the pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical companies, you know, they Purdue paid $634.5 million. No one went to jail. And when I interviewed one of the executives who was on probation, I mean, he got probation. He had to check in with his probation officer before he left the state lines. And that was just horrible for his father, who he thought was just a hero, you know. But, you know, as soon as even in the sentencing hearing, they said they took no responsibility for it. And denial in every quarter, just like Ronnie Jones, not being the drug dealer, not being able to see that what he seeded in his community, whether or not he gave Jesse Balstridge the drug that resulted in his life-ending overdose, or somebody else did who bought it from somebody Ronnie started as a heroin dealer. I mean, he saw no remorse either. The only remorse I see out there on the ground, as I reported this story, is from the family members. You know, they're just so grieving, and they're basically left alone to deal with the worst drug epidemic in the history of our nation. Many second-guessing themselves. I shouldn't have left. You know, I thought it was just pills. Why did I not know? And that's the only remorse I've seen.
I'm really shocked about that with the doctors, to be honest with you. Maybe I'm naive, but
I mean, I've said this before, but I think every doctor who, I just don't think they want to face it because it's so hard, and it would also sort of admit that they played a guilty role in it. But I said this in a community discussion at a Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute. So this is our fancy new medical school that has this addiction research. They get millions of dollars in grants. And I watched person after person who lived in that same area not be able to access treatment while scholars and researchers getting all this grant money. And I said, in a room full largely of medical people, this is right before the book came out, I felt like any doctor who ever accepted a free item from a pharmaceutical company because they gave away free trips, OxyContin beach hats, mugs, Pain is a Fifth Vital Sign clipboards. I mean, I have a big collection of all this stuff now, ought to feel morally compelled to help get us out of this crisis. And what would that take? If so many doctors don't want to have, quote, addicts in their waiting room, they don't want to become a part of the solution. And maybe they were lied to about the addictiveness of this drug, but as I said, the horse is out of the barn. They need to help get us out of it because they certainly played a role in helping get us into it. And, you know, journalists know better. We don't accept free meals. We don't accept free things from people we write about. Doctors went on, you know, 5,000 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists became paid spokesman for Purdue Pharma and went out and preached the notion for a lot of pay that this drug was, quote, as this coffee mug I have sitting on my desk says, the drug to start with, the one to start with, and the one to stay with. Jeez. So,
I mean, I ask because, I have a friend who went through something, I mean, basically this, addicted to fentanyl, fortunately came out the other side and had gone through detox, and, you know, everybody was sort of amazed that they saw a guy who made it after being addicted to fentanyl. And his doctor, you know, gave him a sort of a weak apology, frankly. It was like, you know, sorry about that. And, I mean, is there any, like, structural change within that profession? I mean, obviously there's rules, and maybe the AMA came out with certain ethics standards, but is there something structural to sort of say, like, it's not enough for you to rely on these people? We just had a massive failure in the system because you were like, you know, I just trusted them, like, without having to do any due diligence.
Right, because they're so busy, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we're all busy. But, it is more, now they have to report if they accept free items, even free lunches. And I'm told that's the only thing that they've gotten rid of the most egregious practices, like doctors having Purdue reps or pharma reps sign up to sponsor their kids' birthday parties at an amusement park. You know, that happened. That's not happening anymore. Part of what healthcare reform was, now there's, you know, a website where you can look and see which doctors accept free things. But I'm told the free lunches are still happening. And, you know, I tell the story early on of the one doctor in his practice that realized it was wrong. And he, you know, he would slink to the office fridge and get his cold leftovers from home. And the doctors would say, well, we can't take the free lunches, because what would the staff do without their free lunches? Well, they'd bring a sandwich from home like the rest of America does, right? And I just think if you look at France, they expanded their treatment capacity by 10 by removing the waiver that all doctors have to become waiver and DEA approved to be buprenorphine prescribers. And that's an easy thing we could do. They cut their overdose rates in half when they took this waiver requirement away. We don't require them to be waivered special treatment. We don't require a special waiver for them to be able to prescribe opioids. Why do we require a special waiver for them to prescribe the treatment for opioid addiction? So there's a lot of things, if we had some national leadership.
Oh, wait a second. I just want to be clear on what you said. So you can prescribe opioids till the cows come home, but you cannot prescribe any drugs that are to mitigate an opioid addiction without getting special permission, essentially, from the DEA.
It's an 8-hour course, and then DEA has to sign off. I'm told it's a bit cumbersome. But the biggest thing is the doctors themselves don't want to have, quote, addicts in their waiting room. I mean, people with opioid use disorder can be really hard to treat and to manage, and it's you know, it's really a high maintenance kind of thing. But until we get, if everybody sort of spread out the burden, then we could, you know, we could share the cost and the time of this, and we could prevent so many future overdose deaths.
All right. Lastly, I mean, is there one, I mean, obviously you spoke to tens, if not hundreds of people over the course of several years. But is there one story that that continues to sort of follow you around when you think about the misery that this created?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. And I'm actually going to be speaking in Tennessee this week. I was really blown away by East Tennessee State University. They started this collaboration where they brought all their different healthcare providers in the state, church-based groups, all these different groups. They applied for treatment monies and they got it. So they got organized, right? And they stopped just operating out of silos, because the biggest barrier to this is everybody sees the problem through the lens of how they get paid. You know, criminal justice doesn't want to let go of their money into treatment, right? But in Tennessee, they started this collaboration, and they were able to convince this rural community that had a bad opioid problem but didn't want to open a treatment center because, quote, we don't want those people in our backyard, even though privately they many admitted they had it in their own families. And so what it takes, and I saw this over and over again, not just there but other places, is leadership and people being willing to go out and explain to communities that don't want a nonprofit methadone clinic in their backyard, for instance, or a nonprofit outpatient buprenorphine program, or a syringe exchange. They just have to go out there and be willing to spread the message, bring experts in from other communities where these things have opened and it hasn't caused more harm. In fact, it has caused more good. And I tell the story of this doctor who himself is in recovery, begging this community to let them open this nonprofit methadone clinic. And somebody raised their hand and said, how many chances do we give these people? And he said he thought of the disciple asking Jesus, how many times should a sinner be forgiven? Should he get forgiven 70 times or 7 times? And the doctor answered to this largely, you know, rural Bible Belt community what Jesus said, which was 70 times 7. It's a chronic relapsing disease. It takes as many times as it takes.
Beth Macy, the book is Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we will put a link to that. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, where we will talk more, obviously, about Brett Kavanaugh. give you the latest on that. There's also, we'll go over the Manafort cooperation agreement. This, I got to say, you know, we had touched on it briefly on Friday. We did not have the details. I think we had just literally, as we were getting on air, heard that he had agreed to cooperate. There was certainly a plea deal. But this cooperation agreement is robust.
Yeah.
And
is there witness protection in there?
Well, you know, it doesn't say in that. And I'm not sure that that would be part of it if we that we could see. But certainly, I mean, there were a couple of things that people are talking about it that make it unique in the context of the Mueller investigation. Also, my understanding is that Mueller's people had met with Manafort on multiple occasions. There was a real the sense I get from afar with the Manafort thing was that they were coming in and trying to make deals with Mueller. And Mueller was like, we want it all. Like, this is going to be an incredibly one-sided deal.
You want an all-the-cut deal.
And I think that's basically what it was. It's like they were just like, you're going to die in prison multiple times. or you're gonna come and you're gonna sign on to the deal that we've already written. No negotiations. You really get that sense when you look at the outlines of this deal. But we will talk more about that in the...
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
Obviously, I look like Paulie, but in Goodfellas, Paulie got flipped on by Henry. But this time, I do flip it.
All right. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. We are a day or two away. We're just waiting now. We have resubmitted the iOS app. We are waiting for approval. That should come any moment or day now. The iOS app has been updated. You can organize your downloaded shows if you'd like to download them, or you can stream them. You can call the show from the app. You can IM the show from the app if you are a member. That will be a new member feature going forward. IMing will be for members only, as we're getting a lot of stuff going forward. Now, as always on this program, if you cannot afford a membership, send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Wait an inordinate amount of time, and then I will get to your email about it. But members will also have the ability to search, and we have an updated search on the new iOS app, and I think this is going to be implemented on the Android app as well. You'll be able to search all the archives, and you'll be able to use any terms. So you'll have access to all the archives you can listen to, but you can search it. So interested in opioids, and every time opioids were brought up, and of course in the new and improved podcast notes era. Thank you, Jamie. I'm not going to say what era was not the best.
I'm quite proud of my minimalist approach.
MF-er, I want more iced tea.
You will be able
totally
to search.
Sure.
But someday we'll have someone go back into the deep archives and do. But nevertheless.
Yeah, good luck. Enjoy yourself.
If there's anybody out there who wants to listen to 1,500 podcasts, please let us know.
It'd be really good for your mental health to listen to the run-up to the 2016 election.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Exactly.
I don't think
If you stop around November 3rd of 2016 and then just go away somewhere, it might be fine.
You can only submit questions if you're a member, but you can be a member for free.
Join the majority report.com. today is Monday. Tomorrow will be Tuesday. The Michael Brooks Show will happen, and this person will be on it.
Ilona Minkowski. We're talking champagne socialism and plenty and new organizing out of McDonald's. And we always have a fun time. This Sunday's Illicit History is on climate action with Joshua Kahn, our second in our series with him. He's a professional organizer. Patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie.
So today, actually, we dropped a bonus for our patrons from the Jake Flores episode that we recorded last week. We mainly talk about this week in Elon Musk, but also Jake tells us a very long, sad, but amusing story of his experience chasing Joe Rogan around L.A., trying to get on his show after he gave him sort of a vague promise of that. So that's pretty amusing. And then yesterday we recorded a new episode with David Kleon, who's a writer for lots of places, including The Nation and BuzzFeed. We took a rare sojourn into the electoral sphere to talk about the results of the primaries, particularly Julia Salazar, friend of the show.
You don't even recognize you don't even recognize that elections take place generally.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are enough other podcasts that talk about that stuff that I figure we can do something else. But we care very much about the Julia Salazar campaign. We broke that down a little bit. We talked about some of the reactions from both the right and center to these progressive victories. We also talk about the Russia stuff a little bit, because David Kleon has a very good take for what the left should take from the Russia corruption scandal. So check it out.
Matt?
The Scarlet Letter this weekend, me, Alex, and a female voice, Kara, joins us.
Just a female voice?
I love how the graphic she's disembodied. Just pops up.
It's not the graphic. This is the YouTube page where you can subscribe at. We're pushing 900 subscribers. Look at that. 100% like rate on that. So you can see people are really enjoying it. So check it out.
All right. I like Hangover.
We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. Right back after this.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.